This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 7th, 2018. Welcome, I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On the 50th edition of the Breaker.News podcast, you'll hear the Is It Just Me commentary. Around the Rim, news from around the Pacific Rim. Cascadia Calling, news from around the Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature, with less than 2 weeks until voters elect new mayors and councillors across British Columbia. First, I interviewed David Chen, who was running for mayor of Vancouver as the leader of the pro-Vancouver party. I also interviewed Hong Guo, who is aiming to upset incumbent mayor Malcolm Brody in Richmond's civic election. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who deserve it. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or are you also concerned about the state of our democracy, or what we call democracy? Election Day is October 20th across British Columbia, but early voting begins this week. Look up your local government website, go to civicinfo.ca, visit your nearest public library, or call Municipal Hall for more information. Check your local community newspaper for information about candidates. Our grandparents and great-grandparents fought for our right to vote, but what would they say today about how our elections have declined? Elections are being run out of City Hall offices by city clerks, not by a third party like Elections BC. Allegations of vote buying in Surrey are under RCMP investigation. Loopholes in the big money law are allowing Vancouver and District Labour and the QP Union to continue to influence politicians and voters. We already saw developer Peter Wall spend $85,000 on billboards and Facebook ads to promote Hector Bremner's run for the mayoralty in Vancouver. None of this inspires confidence in the system. In order for democracy to flourish, the system must be stable and it must be transparent. But don't let it stop you from voting. But if you don't plan to vote at all, please don't stay silent. If you have lost confidence in the system, we need to know why, so it can be fixed. So tell me, and I will air your comments in the weeks to come. Email me, bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Canis Leung reports, two PolyU students in hunger strike over school's handling of democracy wall. Two university students in Hong Kong launched a hunger strike on October 5th to protest the school taking control of a bulletin board on which messages advocating the city's independence from China were posted earlier. Polytechnic University Student Union President Lam Wing Hung and Victor Yuen Pak Leung said they would not end their action until the school reinstated their rights to the democracy wall, where messages are affixed for passers-by to see. Meanwhile, Nectar Gan reports, Chinese police to get power to inspect internet service providers. Effective November 1st, police in China can enter the business sites, machine rooms, and offices of internet service providers, ranging from internet information providers and internet cafes to data centers. Police can then require the managers to explain all items they inspect, to look up and copy all relevant information, and they can check how technical measures to safeguard network and information security are running. Apart from on-site inspections, the police can now also conduct remote detection of any network security vulnerabilities in the companies, but they are required to give them advance notice and make sure it will not disrupt or damage the operations of their networks. In the Japan Times, Corey Baird reports, Toyota and SoftBank to integrate mobility and AI in new venture. Two titans of Japanese industry, Toyota Motor Corp. and SoftBank Group Corp., said October 4th that they are setting up a new joint venture to develop autonomous driving technologies and other on-demand services, including food deliveries, medical care, and office space. Funded with an initial investment of $17.5 million, the new company, Monet Technologies Corp., will begin operations as early as next March. While the on-demand services will initially roll out using traditional vehicles, by 2020, the company is aiming to utilize Toyota's driverless concept vehicle, ePalette. A 2016 report from Rand Corp, however, stated that autonomous vehicles would have to be driven hundreds of millions of miles and sometimes hundreds of billions of miles to demonstrate their reliability in terms of fatalities and injuries. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines about the Pacific Northwest. In the Bellingham Herald, David Rosbach reports, Bellingham Fire Chief, we will not obtain training on recently deceased patients. Training on recently deceased patients will no longer be an accepted practice for Bellingham Fire Department paramedics, as the department's policy has been clarified in response to a dead man being intubated by 11 employees July 31st on the floor of Station 1. Patient care and procedures should only be provided with the goal of patient resuscitation, said Assistant Supervising Physician Dr. Emily Junk in an emailed statement to the Bellingham Herald. After a patient has been pronounced as deceased, no further procedures should be provided without consent of next of kin or durable power of attorney. 12 department employees were disciplined September 17th for their role in the July 31st incident. EMS Captain Scott Farlow submitted his resignation on September 17th, while Medical Services Officer and Division Chief Mannix McDonnell resigned September 20th. The city had earlier told the Herald that one of the supervisors had retired. In the Oregonian, Mike Rugaway reports, Wyden seeks inquiry into reported Chinese cyber attack on Portland company. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden said he will seek to uncover the truth of a highly contentious report alleging a spy attack on hardware made for a Portland technology company. Bloomberg Businessweek reported October 4th that Chinese spies planted a stealth chip into computers made for Portland-based Elemental Technologies. The Businessweek cover story said Amazon discovered the attack as it reviewed the Portland startup's security protocols ahead of acquiring the company in 2015. Elemental, known as AWS Elemental, following its sale to Amazon, makes software for streaming video over the internet on standard computer hardware. And in the British Columbia local elections, which are coming October 20th, The Breaker reported that Elections BC is reviewing Victoria blackmail complaint. Mayoral candidate Mike Gagan said he received an email early September 28th from someone named Tim Stone under the subject Five Steps to a Cleaner Victoria Election Campaign. The email proposed a four-for-one deal and urged Gagan to remove a blog post alleging mayoral candidate Stephen Hammond of the new council slate had paid for a certain social media advertising that was critical of Gagan. It called Gagan's claims false and easy to demonstrate. Just 2 days earlier, Gagan had complained to the Law Society of BC, alleging that Hammond, a non-practicing lawyer, had paid an alleged fraudster to attack the Gagan campaign on Facebook. Hammond was challenged by another candidate, Bruce McGuigan, at an October 2nd CFAX radio debate about a mysterious social media campaign boosting Hammond's slate and attacking others. Hammond said that, as far as the websites, I've got to tell you, if other people are choosing on their own right to be slamming other candidates and not me, I can't help that. I don't even spend time. I'm at the doors. End quote. Elections BC spokesman Andrew Watson confirmed receipt of Gagan's complaint. Gagan also complained to Victoria Police. And Toronto firm returns for another poll about Vancouver mayoral candidates and parties. A month after its poll that included the name of a Vision Vancouver supporter's baby among mayoral candidates, Main Street Research is working on a follow-up. This time it focuses on mayoral candidates and municipal parties. The list of parties omitted COPE, Vision Vancouver, and Coalition Vancouver. COPE was also omitted from the September 3rd and 4th robocall poll by Main Street. This time, however, Vancouver First's Fred Harding was included among the mayoral hopefuls. The survey in September of 862 people found Kennedy Stewart was leading at 14%, with Ken Sim and Hector Bremner under 8%. Almost 42% of respondents at the time were undecided. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The Vancouver civic election is rapidly approaching on October 20th. Back in April, when the field was less crowded, financial planner David Chin threw his hat in the ring to become mayor when he formed the new party, Pro Vancouver. Chen is a financial planner who has degrees in psychology. He has been a scuba diver, a ham radio operator, and a forklift driver, among other things. Chen says the city needs a new citywide plan to give locals priority for housing instead of foreign speculators. He also wants to get City Hall finances in order, and he says it is not too late to rethink the Broadway subway, which he says is too expensive and doesn't go far enough. I began by asking David Chen why he would want to become mayor of a city that is facing so many social and economic problems in 2018.
That's a fantastic question. I mean, that's something that, again, it's sort of very personal in the sense that as a person born and raised in Vancouver, I first have to say I don't really have any other home. This is the only home I've known for my entire life, and I've watched it change, not in very good ways. And as a family person, I've watched the affordability of housing go down so that my kids don't have a future, and pretty much everybody else's kids I know of don't have a future either. So it's come down to the public has, in my opinion, has lost a lot of faith in our governance, and they've lost a lot of faith in the candidates. And really, I think what people needed for quite a while is what I like to call a ground fighter. You know, we've got a lot of candidates who do have a lot of credentials, but they're very high level. They're not people that have worked in the community very much. And for 25 years, I've donated my time volunteering with a variety of organizations just to make sure that our community space is a little bit better. And I think with all that knowledge and experience about what Vancouver was, what it has become, and what its limitations are, I think that's what people are looking for. Last night was a great example. We were at the Falls Creek Residents Association, and you know, we get a lot of people trying to promise lowering taxes as an example. And it sounds great on paper, but you know, with a financial background, I can tell you this, if you don't deal with the budget, lowering taxes will only trigger a deficit and force the city to go into borrowing, which means that it's just going to increase the problem on taxpayers. So I think really what people are looking for is that jack of all trades and a ground fighter that can lead this battle to, you know, save Vancouver for our people.
What about other aspects of looking at how the city has changed in recent years to really get into the books and find out what went on behind the scenes, especially in the big money era when Vision Vancouver was in charge? There's a lot of evidence that can be found of possible corruption, that City Hall has sold land for bargain basement prices to donors.
I agree with you. I mean, corruption is kind of a strong word, but what I can say is that there's certainly a lot of anomalies. And last night, again, at the residents meeting, I was put on the track that if you want to look up the assessment for where Concord Pacific's presentation center is, it's valued at a dollar. And it's true. I looked it up on BC Assessment. I was stunned to see the building's worth $10,000, and the property itself is worth a dollar. That's completely insane. So, you know, looking at the finances, I can see annotations for transfers in kind for CACs. And for those who don't know what that is, it's a community amenity contribution. It's essentially part of what developers pay to build up the infrastructure of the city as they introduce more density. The challenge with that is from a financial planning perspective, that is so red flagged by CRA. I mean, if you try and pull that off, your tax return is going to be pulled out in a heartbeat and you're going to be investigated with a microscope. So I don't understand why the city is constantly doing this sort of horse trading and very low valuations, as well as, you know, kind of very closed, non-transparent transactions. And I think it's these anomalies, and I agree with you. I've actually talked to a forensic auditor, and a friend of mine, she's looked at the books from sort of a surface perspective. And she says, well, you know, from an audit, you're not necessarily going to find anything here. But what you do need to do is look into the core reviews, and you need to look into the contracts, because that's where kickbacks are. And so we have an idea of where we have to go. And I think that certainly if we can find out where all this misspending is, you know, then we can actually lower the costs that the city has to run the city. And then that could actually lead to an actual reduction in taxation. Or at least if we're not going to do that, make sure we are delivering the services to the people that they actually are paying for and that they deserve.
And under the responsive City Hall portion of your platform, you talk about making public data easier to access online. But what about access to information? Despite Mayor Greg Robertson promising transparency and accountability, he used Gmail to get around the FOI laws. His ex-chief of staff, Mike McGee, deleted his email weekly. There's a very large communications department there. They want to control and manage information instead of unleash it and let the citizens in to understand exactly how their money's being spent.
Here's the thing. I mean, reality check with having over 10 years of experience with governance of a very large strata. There are some times that you do have to keep some things confidential, but it's usually with business transactions in play. But once the transaction or the contract is done, just like with the province or the feds, that information should be made available to people. So we are committed to lifting that veil of secrecy, so to speak, and making it so that a lot of this data can be easily searched on your own on the city website. We do think that that's what makes people accountable, first of all. But the second thing that's popped up, and it's a discussion that we had at False Creek yesterday, and also something I recognize being a strata president for almost 10 years, there is a need for a continuity of knowledge. So what I mean by that is the Falls Creek residents have been complaining that Creekside Park has been promised since like the 1990s, and yet nothing has been built. But along the way, the leaders have changed, the people in play have changed, and the knowledge of what was actually promised has started to wane. And so I think what we need to do is to have that transparency of documentation so that we don't forget what happened. You know, my own situation, my own experience, I remember when I first moved into Yale Town, we had this discussion about whether or not there would be a new casino near where I live. And the residents, myself included, went to public hearing to say, well, you know, we're very concerned about that. And at that point, the project was deep six. Yet, right now we see Park Casino standing right there. So something had changed because the memory of the voters and the people around was lost. So I think we do need to go back to that to make sure that when we do set up community plans, when we do have promises that are made between cities, developers, and various interest parties, that they are actually maintained. Right now, I think that the average voter is feeling quite upset that it seems to be whatever a developer wants right now, they get. But whatever a developer promised before, but they don't really want to do, we don't have to follow through with that, which is a very one-sided kind of a discussion. So we need to change that. We need to go back to where everything is transparent, where people understand what's happening with their money, what's happening with services and negotiations, and that promises that are actually made are actually delivered.
Incumbent Richmond, BC Mayor Malcolm Brody is facing a challenge from real estate and immigration lawyer Hong Guo in the October 20th civic election. Guo has attracted media attention for being accused of professional misconduct by the Law Society of British Columbia and for being named in a $13 million lawsuit over a collapsed real estate deal. None of the allegations has been proven. The Breaker sat down with Guo after the October 2nd mayoral debate in the Richmond Senior Center. The Vancouver suburb is home to 200,000 people, of which 60% are ethnic Chinese. The Breaker wanted to know more about Guo's desire to foster closer ties between Richmond and China. Here is what she had to say.
What's your message? Because there's a lot of concern in Richmond. You do want to build bridges between Richmond and China. There's people in the Hong Kong community, the Taiwanese community, people that are concerned about human rights, that say that maybe Canada already has close enough ties with China, and China has some very serious problems when it comes to human rights, lack of freedom of press, for instance.
I don't think so. I do not agree.
Why don't you agree?
I think China has a lot of freedom of speech. Yes.
China has lots of freedom? You're on the record saying that?
Yes, sir.
Journalists are in jail in China.
People
that do my work are in jail in China. How do you say that?
I don't believe it.
You don't believe that? Yeah. People who are journalists...
I don't believe it.
You don't believe what Human Rights Watch says, what Amnesty International says?
No.
You don't believe what independent groups say about journalists who get jailed in China?
I don't believe it. Yeah.
Why don't you believe that?
Because I know so many people in China, and I have never heard about this.
Never heard about journalist being jailed in China?
Yeah, never.
Really?
Yeah. You have never been in China, I guess. There's a lot of... That's why...
I can show you my passport.
Yeah, that's why...
I've traveled extensively in China.
Yeah, that's why I want to be bridge. There's so much misunderstanding.
There's
lots of misunderstanding.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, there were 41 journalists in jail in China last year. Turkey, with 73, was the only country with more. Amnesty International said 10 journalists from 64tianwang.com were in jail at the end of 2017. The website reports on protests in China. Last week, China refused to renew the visa of Financial Times Asia editor Victor Mallet. Mallet is the vice president of the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club, which hosted a forum in August, which included a fringe politician who campaigns for Hong Kong's independence from China.
What do you think that the public will think when they hear that? That you think that there's no problem for journalists in China? When independent organizations around the world...
People would agree with me.
Really, people would agree with you.
99.9% people will agree with me.
Really, do you think that the editor of New York Times would agree with you?
Yes.
The editor of New York Times would agree with you. The editor of the Wall Street Journal would agree with you.
The Wall Street, of course, is American, but they don't really understand the Chinese policy or situation. Mm-hmm. You go to China to stay there for 5 years, and you will find it out. You are wrong.
Really? Okay.
Yes. You are so very much wrong.
So the people, the top level, the BBC... The
BBC, I don't know. And the Chinese media in China, yeah, they have very much freedom and to talk and to criticize and to make suggestions. No problem.
So Amnesty International is all wrong. Human Rights Watch is all wrong. They're all wrong?
Yes, sir.
Really?
If they are saying so, they are wrong.
At the end of August, the United Nations called on China to free Uyghur Muslims from re-education camps. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination estimated that up to 1 million people were in camps in Xinjiang, the Muslim province in China's far west. The same report also criticized the Chinese government for how it blocks Tibetans from international travel and how it suppresses the Tibetan language.
I mean, I'm asking you these questions because you want to build closer bridges to China, between Richmond and China. And I'm asking about your knowledge of the human rights abuses of China.
There's no human rights abuse in China.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you know what's happening right now in Xinjiang, the re-education camps?
What do you know? And how can you know? Did you visit that camp?
There's international observers from various international organizations who are accredited by the United Nations who have observed it. There's academics at UBC, a fellow named Sean Zhang, who has done international work to pinpoint where the re-education camps are.
Okay, then go to visit and then see by your eyes. Because I have so many friends, business partners, and relatives. They are in China. They are there every day. They know better than you. They are no better than CBC. They know better than the New York Times. They do.
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or group of people that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to farmers, the people that work hard to bring you the food that keeps you healthy. It's Thanksgiving in Canada, a time to celebrate the harvest. So think of those who grow the food and tend the livestock. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 7th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me for this, the 50th edition. Did you know that on October 7th in 1988, Alaskan hunter Inupiaq found three gray whales trapped in Beaufort Sea ice near Point Barrow, Alaska? The world began to watch as U.S. and Soviet ships came to the rescue. One of the whales died in what was called Operation Breakthrough, but it is believed the other two got away. It inspired the 2012 movie Big Miracle. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. Thanks to some of our supporters like Quan Lee, Randy Sogstad, James Plett, Spruce Hill Contracting, Daryl Greer, Barbara May, Elvio Chiez, John Kennedy, and Dave and Burnaby. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.